to South Africa last week, as you know. Then I received the request as we were with the tickets and 45 minutes before departure time. Please stay here and keep doing what you're doing until the sanctions are voted. It may be that the people can cause their representatives to follow their wishes for a change. I mean, we got senators that think they're an oligarchy. You need to call them and say, you're not an oligarchy. You're supposed to do what we want you to do. And I ask you to call your senator. If you haven't called him already, do it first thing in the morning. Call your city library, ask them who your senator is and what the number is. And they'll tell you. You call him and tell him you want him to vote no against the sanctions. Now, I never tell people why I'm recommending something. Or let me put it another way, I never recommend anyone to do anything without telling them why. And you make your own mind up. But I think the South African issue has been oversimplified. I do not believe in race prejudice. I don't think the problem is race. I think that's a symptom. The real problem is we're just all sinners. And sin usually is not defined rightly. It's really not all these little things the church has been majoring on. They've been majoring on minors. The root of all sin is this rebellion against God and His will. We just want to be the boss, and we want to be on top. It's a power thing. Now, if God had cursed Shem and blessed Ham, we whites would be running around screaming racism. But because of that ding-a-ling Ham, our black brothers have had to suffer some consequences down through the years. Now, I preach that there's only one race you all belong to, and that's the Christ race. New creation in Christ Jesus. We're all kings and priests before God there. And everybody can get into that one. But it's a power problem. It's the ins versus the outs. And it's wrong, and the moral attitude of the world has been aroused. But statesmanship cannot become unrealistic. And morality has limits in international relations. I said this morning, I think, how many of you remember when the news media called Ayatollah a holy man? As if they're a good judge. And when the Shah was dispossessed and the people were running around with machine guns, I remember the article that said the people now have the guns. I'm hearing all these people up there yelling about the First Amendment. Tell the black people in the United States about the First Amendment prior to the Civil War. You think that piece of paper got the job done by itself? You're going to be immoral about, if you're going to apply a 1985 standard of morality that exists in the United States to race relations in South Africa, then suit up, my friends, and invade the damn country and do what the North did in the 1860s. Put your body where your mouth is. Get all these news people wanting somebody else to die for their morality. Black or white. Now, I expect to be misunderstood as I matriculate here for a minute or two with my words. But I've got years to rely on in regard to my attitude about race. I don't see color except the red blood of Jesus. I refuse to let anybody intimidate me on the subject. And it's as though you speak facts. And you must be afraid for fear you'll be called racist. My friend, the facts are, black people didn't free themselves in the United States. The only revolution we had was the one where the whites whipped the English fighting Indian technique, dirty. Them redcoats marched down the street fighting fair and got shot in the bottom by the American frontiersmen. We had an awful lot of back shooters shooting from the brush. That's how we came into existence. And the father of our country wasn't such a moral giant. He tried to father the country solely by himself. You know, ever so often we're talking about the father of our country, we ought to sympathize with his old lady. Got left out of the process in more ways than one. If the wood is not burning, could talk. History is his story, and might makes right. Now, are we prepared to suit up and send the grand old Northern Army north of the equator, Europe and the United States, to invade South Africa and effect a revolution that guarantees will be reconstituted on the high moral tone of Western nations and supervise elections? If we aren't, we better quit preaching as though South Africa is 1985 or even 1865 United States in this social frame of reference. I'm not justifying them any more than I justify America before it happened. I don't justify the fact that a lot of preachers were preaching and rationalizing their attitude toward the blacks. Look at the attitude of the Chinese toward the Westerners. We were all infidels. And the majority of the Chinese in that nation called China still think all of us, black and white, are inferior beings. You're not going to change them by saying, "Thus saith the law. All men are born equal." Well, hell yes. They don't believe it. And we're never going to discuss this problem sanely until we quit looking through a set of glasses with one frame. Redneck Southern preacher Jerry Falwell, who has to get back at Jesse Jackson by reminding him he spit on a salad and served white people with it. And Jesse Jackson making his points against Jerry Falwell that he always was apartheid in the South, and he just transferring it to South Africa. Apartheid, in my judgment, is evil. But it's not a race problem if the Zulus have been ruling. they would have had to justify their feeling of superiority. And let me tell you, if you've ever been a missionary as I have, and trekked into some of these places, they don't start out saying, "Yes, Juana." I've been in some areas where they like white meat. I mean, I've been reminded on more than one occasion of my rather thoughtless ordering. Each time I order fried chicken, I say, "I want the chicken boobs. I like the white meat. Don't give me any legs, don't give me any wings, don't give me any back. Just give me, order chicken boobs. You have to call, charge me double. I want chicken boobs. I like breast meat. I like white meat." That really came home to me about 100 miles north of Manila when I trekked into one of those villages that's still practicing headhunting, my first trip overseas, or Dutch New Guinea. I can still wake up in the middle of the night and see that rather lick-lipping, glint in the eye of that old chief in Dutch New Guinea when he looked at me. I was sorry instantly that I had not gone on a 30-day fast before I went on that trip. Boy, you want to look like they'd have to pick bones out of their teeth for months to eat you when you go to those places. Whites have not got a premium on superior views of themselves. They're stupid other people, too. If you're allowed to get away with it a while, you convince yourself. God has created all of us in such a way we cannot continue in any activity we're involved in very long without convincing ourselves it's right. And when a generation has been raised on that convincing, you can't change them overnight. That's why the communists have known, grab education. Now, South Africa is not a simple little mix. Now, they've been able to live down there on the tip of the south of Africa, but modern communication has brought them to the world, and a moral standard has been laid on them. And I believe, though I think morality can be pushed too far in relations, and that's what Reinhold Niebuhr said. You can't lay our moral judgments on people in international relationships. You have a trustee role. And you may be violating someone's unspoken rights as you take an ethic that works in one-on-one relationships and try to apply it to the larger sphere where you're acting on the behalf of people. Now, the tension the world's been gotten, we've been knocking on the head of South Africa and the Botha government. I don't really care if somebody proves they were Nazis during the earlier development. Some of those who were the principals. The facts are, Botha came to power saying it's change or die, and they're trying to change. And Reagan's philosophy of constructive engagement says work behind the scenes. Don't bring it to the breaking point. Now, the private sanctions have been felt. Do we know enough about South Africa to push it to the breaking point and create the circumstance like that of Zimbabwe that will produce revolution and bloodshed on both sides? Now, we've heard from Jesse Jackson. He's been there a week or two. And we've heard from Jerry Falwell. He's been there maybe a week. And we've heard from Ted Kennedy. He was there a week. And we've heard from some other senator that got arrested for marching. He was there maybe a week. But we haven't heard from the head of the Zulu nation that grew up there and heads 5 million Zulus. Now, I have the leader of what is the largest religious group in South Africa visiting me next Wednesday. And I had determined to go because we're hearing a litany from the press that sounds too much like Iran, too much like Panama Canal. Really did a lot of good to turn the Panama Canal over to that country, didn't it? The same litany on the Suez, same litany on opening up China. Where was the moral refrain there? How quickly we forgot the Red Guard purges. How quickly we forgot Mao. Same litany as North Korea and South Korea. Same litany as North and South Vietnam. I don't think it's that simple. And if the purposes of sanctions was to get the attention of the South African government and get the message across, you better change, then let's back off and give them a chance. International sanctions drove Zimbabwe to civil war, and nobody is better off as a result of it. And communists have taken over. I have a right to say this without being called a racist. You know why I cannot fly my Lear jet, Dockstar 1, to South Africa? Any of you know? Still holds a speed record from Los Angeles to New York and back. I can fly to Europe. Nothing wrong with the plane's ability to go to South Africa. You know why I can't fly to South Africa? You can't overfly the nations of Africa. And if you land in any of them, they won't let you out of the plane. They won't refuel you. They won't service you. And one drifted over their airspace not long ago, and they shot him down. Now, I think I have a right to not be called a racist, to simply say that just maybe, the bleeding hearts brought a people, regardless of race, too quickly into self-determinate existence in a vast continent. I could fill my Lear jet full of black people and fly to the northern nearest airport to the Mediterranean and fill it with all my black friends and head for South Africa, and we'd get our carcass shot down. How come we don't hear from the news media about that? Why don't these bleeding hearts do something for the Indians in America? Huh? Now, communism has a philosophy, and God is the developing process. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in individual immortality. The ultimate value to them is the stream of the process, working according to the law of the dialectic, dialectical materialism. We are but units in the process, like waves on the sea. You can distinguish from wave to wave easier than you can distinguish wave from the sea. Your immortality, if you have one, is in making a contribution to the process. The end justifies the means, and the end is to keep the process going toward its ultimate goal of utopia, which has never been reached in any communist country yet. And the philosophy says that whatever the process as it now is, it will polarize and should polarize into a dialectic extreme, and these should come into conflict. And revolution is a necessary part of the process, and that revolution or splattering creates a new frame of reference in the dialectic that will synthesize, and the synthesis will be better than the synthesis pre-revolution in the previous segment of the process. That new synthesis will polarize into opposites and be brought into conflict, and the conflagration of new revolution will splatter it again and create, because it is an inevitable process of improvement, and the revolution creates a new frame of reference in the splattering that will synthesize into something higher and better that will polarize and revolutionize and synthesize and polarize and revolutionize. And our whole reason for being is to contribute to that process until the utopia comes. That's why they're always ready for revolution. That's their process. That's why they never ask the question, is it bad? They're brainwashed into, it's good. That's part of the necessary process. Their eternal salvation, if I could use the word, the closest thing they have to it is being a part of that process. And then seizing the reins and control to make sure that you're there as the conflagration occurs, to synthesize the better that is inevitable and be a part of it. And then stir up the next conflagration. Now, very few news people understand the philosophy of communism. They think it's Russia. Russia is able to rationalize standing still, not doing it, and perpetuating the rulership that now is, while they help to bring the rest of the world up to their level. A neat little rationale. Doesn't matter how many people, black or white, are killed anywhere in the world, if they can stir up the revolutions elsewhere, they will have their people there to grab the reins of the new synthesis, and they can rationalize, stand where they are, and not having a new revolution, and holding the fort, so to speak, and keeping the leadership they have intact, because they have the moral duty, having arrived where they are, to bring everybody else up to that level. And we're not ready for them. Slip into the VTR room and help them in there, Mike. Stay there, will you? I'd like to call you back. You understand me? Now, South Africa is ripe for such a revolution. And the communists are much smarter than we are. You can call it red baiting. They want the revolution. Do you have any idea what's going to happen to the world when they control? And what's going to happen to the economies of the world? I mean, black America better get their head together for 5 minutes. You ever understand what's going to happen to the world when they control the chromium and the platinum and the gold and the diamonds of South Africa? The world's on an economic crash landing already in its financial policies. Now, it doesn't really matter whether the blacks are going to rebel or not. If we push the whites of South Africa far enough, Botha will have a revolution on the right. He's got hard heads that believe only in the iron fist, who are saying to him, we told you your system wouldn't work. There's only one answer. Fight or be destroyed. Now, I will sit in this chair and tell you that if we don't back off, there will be revolution in South Africa, and it will go communistic the same way Zimbabwe did. The blacks will not be better off. Certainly the blacks in America will not be better off. That's why this isn't a race problem. Race is just the surface symptom. Race is part of it. And race is certainly a current cause of the problem. But racist answers will not solve the problem. Statesmanship must rise above that. And that's my plea, that we now, having gotten their attention, get to your senators and say, back off. 1 year isn't going to make that much difference. But if revolution is triggered, 1 year will make a lot of difference. All I really want is the freedom to talk rationally about South Africa, realistically about South Africa, and raise it above mudslinging and activities and words that simply heighten racial overtones that can never solve the problem. It'll take some education to get racism out of people. It's bad for whites to hate anyone because they're black, and blacks to hate anyone because they're white. And I'm sorry, when I watched that debacle of a debate on Nightline the other night, it was pretty easy for me to figure out that Jesse Jackson and Jerry Falwell had not cured themselves from vestigial remnants of racial hatred. And two wrongs don't make a right. I thought Jesse Jackson was building a rainbow coalition that had women and Mexicans. And if he expects to lead that coalition, he should ask the women and the Mexicans, as well as the blacks, what they think on the subject, if he is going to try to be their spokesman. But I saw a knee-jerk reaction. Knee-jerk reaction. Well, you put the emphasis where you want to put it. A knee-jerk reaction that transferred an issue that's got too much race in it already into a heightened racial argument. And by his body language, Jerry Falwell gave us a knee-jerk relation, reaction. This calls for statesmanship. Anybody that knows South Africa knows the Afrikaners have much deeper hatred for the Englishmen they fought than they do the blacks. They've got some ideas about the blacks that are the product of years of wrong education. But they got living hatred for the English. It's not just whites versus blacks. It's liberal whites versus hardline conservative whites, liberal blacks versus hardline left revolutionary blacks, and a history that has refused to come into the 20th century on Western nation democratic principles, who finally have decided it's change or get swallowed up in a bloodbath followed by communism. And the most they can do is put it off with a bloodbath followed by hardline fascism, which ultimately will result in a second bloodbath, inevitably followed by communist takeover. Now, anarchy produces fascism. And fascism brings revolution. And revolution in the modern world, because they've made a science out of it, and they're close enough to move into the territory, produces communism. The only possible hope for South Africa is avoiding a bloodbath on either side being initiated. The moral weight of the world has been dumped on them. the economic pressure from Western Europe and from private industry in America has been dumped on them. The only friend that they have left in the Western world, in their view, is President Reagan, who has committed himself to a policy of constructive engagement, tough talk behind the scenes, but no encouragement to the leftists by an open attack nationally by the United States government. And the pressure for sanctions has now moved from the private sector to some kind of message that must be sent by the U.S. Congress. Any of those congressmen and senators should know that what has already been done has sent the message. Even an old dog trainer like me knows that the voice will work. Don't pull out the whip. Save it. The essence of artful use of power is exactly that, artful use of it. We've made the point. Now, you've got to give your senators a face-saving way. They can tell all their constituents if they get more pressure on them not to vote than to vote, they can reverse it. The message has been made. I'm not quarreling, and I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not quarreling with the message. I'm certainly not supporting apartheid. I don't justify what they've done. Frankly, I think it's just as much a male versus female issue as it is a black versus white. The so-called immorality law in South Africa. Has not prevented colored people from developing. And colored people do not develop by natural genetic process. Now, I've always said the ultimate answer to the race problems is intermarriage. The absolute ultimate solution. But I'm not stupid.
A white woman becomes pregnant, it's pretty obvious she violated the Anti-Morality Act. White men don't get pregnant. White men been making it with black women and colored women in South Africa for years. And the vice versa has been desired, but is very risky. Because when a white woman becomes pregnant, you got yourself a rather obvious violation. When a black or colored child is born. So the act itself made violation by white men with black and colored women relatively difficult to spot, but very easy to enforce against black men having an affair with a white woman. If you think the law has kept the white men from fooling around, the law has really served their purpose. It's just broadened their territory and limited others. The problem is not simply black versus white. It's sin and power and education and the reality of today and the delicate balance in the world economically and in the broader line between the communist takeover of countries and the whites in the Western democracies. And we are over killing. That's my argument. And what will 1 year's time do? And the news media is saying the same thing too often for me to find it believable. So I decided I was going to go and see and look for myself. And they then said, no, stay and do what you're doing. And come later. So I stayed, and I'm doing what I'm doing, and going to go later. But now I hear one is flying to see me on Wednesday, but that's not enough. I want to go. Now, where and how did the South African problem develop? The Britishers developed a landed aristocracy. Unlike Europe, they didn't have noble families with nobles holding their position by genealogy. They achieved their power by business and by war and by strength and by smarts. And a landed aristocracy developed where the people became active in politics, active in business, active in war. And in the great boys' school in England, trained all the sons to be active. But only the oldest son could inherit. So a surplus of young Englishmen began to spill out on the world to use that training and energy. And into the midst of that came the philosophy of John Ruskin. John Ruskin was named, thanks to the Slade bequest, Professor of Fine Arts at Oxford. Now, you must understand that man simply cannot engage in anything over a long period of time without convincing himself that it's right. And the British were sending these active, well-trained young men out, making a bundle, and getting rich. John Ruskin gave him the moral frame, I believe he is sincere. But he didn't just talk about fine arts. He talked about it in terms of moral issues. Until the end of the 19th century, the poverty-stricken masses in the cities of England lived in want. There is nobody in Soweto, in South Africa. There is no plantation in the South that had downtrodden blacks as slaves who lived in worse circumstances than the poverty-stricken masses in the cities of England until the end of the 19th century. See, I'm a historian. I refuse to let some people apply only one standard, today's modern America, to the moral issues of the world. I travel as a missionary. I used to listen to missionaries come home and say how terrible it was over there. James Michener was right. The Hawaiians were happy. Until those Puritan missionaries arrived there to ruin it for them. Now, I'm a preacher and I know that. I just love that movie, Hawaii. I just squint my eyes and I can see the superintendent that, and his assistant that were involved in my ordination. The whites, the downtrodden, poverty-stricken masses in England, in the cities of England, until the end of the 19th century, 1899, were in worse shape than the slaves in the South in the United States. That doesn't make slavery right. Slavery's wrong. I disagree with Paul, and that's pretty hard for me to do, in his Philemon letter. I understand why he wrote it. He thought the Lord was coming so soon. He would rather have Philemon and his master make their peace and Philemon be a good slave and the master be a good master than to try to get involved in enacting a Christian crusade against slavery. He thought by the time he set that slave free and the rest of them free, the Lord would have come and gone, so better make him a good Christian. That was the rationale. They thought the Lord was so imminent, social change wasn't worth the energy. Save as many as you can before the Lord comes. They were wrong. Slavery was wrong. But suffering doesn't have a particular color foci. Now, it is true. Western nations, dominated by entrenched white leadership, have got the jump on. Native populations in many areas of the world and third world countries. But the solution is not going to come pitting race against race. Statesmanship has to come in, and an understanding that you can't judge everyone psychologically by your frame of reference. That's why Paul to the Romans said, if you think something's a sin, it's a sin for you. I know better. I can smoke this, but if you think it's wrong, you better not do it. It's a sin for you. We're not all alike. And South Africa is not like the United States. Here's why. Ruskin came along and spoke to the Oxford undergraduates as members of a privileged ruling class. He told them they were the possessors of a magnificent tradition of education, beauty, rule of law, freedom, decency, and self-discipline. But this tradition could not be saved and didn't deserve to be saved unless it could be extended to the lower classes in England itself and to the non-English masses throughout the world. I'm reading from Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope. Don't go try to buy it. I don't think you can find it. A History of the World in Our Time, former professor at Georgetown and many of the other Eastern establishment schools. If this precious tradition, he said, were not extended to these two great majorities, the downtrodden of England and the non-English masses, the minority of upper-class Englishmen would ultimately be submerged by these majorities and the tradition lost. To prevent this, the tradition must be extended to the masses and to the empire. His inaugural lecture was copied out in longhand by one undergraduate, Cecil Rhodes, who kept it with him for 30 years. He was only one. Ruskin's lectures had such an impact that out of these wealthy families in England, young men were sent out with a moral imperative laid upon them. They had to make the world little Englishmen. Now, do you see too much difference between this and the missionary attitude? We've got to make them all like us. We go as a missionary, and the chief listens to God's message of grace. He's got 30 wives and 72 kids. Here comes the missionary. Slat-shaped wife with her gray bun pulled up tight on top of her head with an attempt to hold her wrinkles in place. And she sees the old chief walk in and his wives lined up, spanning about a 30-year age span. The lowest one's about 16. When she gets home, she jabs her husband and says, "That's a sin." And that little wimp has to go out now and tell the chief, "You got to get rid of 29 of them. Which one do you want to go?" "What?" The chief says, "Yes. Can't baptize you and your 30 wives."